the green light from Andrea. I see there are 9 participants, so I can only humiliate myself 9 times over tonight. I'll do my best. Alrighty. Tonight we're going to be covering Chapter 7 of Tragedy and Hope, which is finance, commercial policy, and business activity for a 50-year period from 1897 to 1947. Once again, after going through this chapter, and for those of you who have been reading Tragedy and Hope, I think you can appreciate the difficulty in trying to extract a cohesive summary of a chapter, because it's such information-rich material, and he jumps around the time horizon a little bit. He also uses language that I find a little bit tricky to follow. I think it's a 1960s type of English, professorial type of language. So I sometimes struggle to extract some of his meaning, but I'll do my best. So I want to just recap. So the previous 6 chapters quickly has given us a general lie of the land geopolitically. Who is who in the West? The history of the West, more or less. Who is who in the East to a lesser extent? The general history and philosophical outlooks of these two hemispheres. Generally, he divides the world into the two. We've covered World War I, the reparations and peace settlements that followed, and the implications of it, and the tensions they created that led to World War II. Chapter 7 brings to light and focuses on the financial side of things. Because quickly covers so much territory, he brings us back along the timelines already covered in general, and in Chapter 7 focuses our attention on the world of finance over a 50-year period, which I've said already. Quickly touched on money earlier in the book. Just as a reminder, he told us about the history of money. He told us what money is and what money is not. And he's taken us through the various financial systems, beginning with a feudal manorial system, commercial capitalism, which led to industrial capitalism, followed by financial capitalism, monopoly capitalism, and technocracy, or a pluralistic economy dealing with lobbying. When quickly touched on his first touch on what banking is, he introduced us to the fractional reserve banking system. And he explained how the banks create money out of nothing. You know, a fractional reserve of the deposit of a bank is in the form of gold. And the percentage that each central bank holds as reserve varies from country to country. As long as there is no run on the bank, in other words, if people don't try to take their money out the bank all at once, then that fractional reserve holds. And as a result, because most people leave their money in the bank most of the time, they can take what is reserved in the bank as deposits, not just gold reserves, but what is then banked by the various people. And they can further fracture that quantity, holding a small deposit as a reserve and then loaning the rest out again, over and over again. So you have gold deposits that can be loaned in a fractional reserve system. Then you can just simply take paper money that is banked and do the same thing. So funny gold becomes funny money. And the banks just create money from nothing, really. And the rest of us are expected to pay back on our loans with interest. And if we can't pay that loan, we are often have to sacrifice our real wealth where the bank can repossess our property. Quite a gig. This system of banking, even if it's a gold standard, it can inflate through this fractional reserve system. They can create more and more and more and more money. And as you see, the central banks can control the size of the bubble. And they do this by controlling what is known as the repo rate. That is, they set the rate at which banks that borrow from them, the interest rate which they are allowed to charge. their customers and the interest that they have to pay back the central banks. So in a sense, by controlling just that one aspect of controlling the repo rate, the central banks can control the size of the bubble. They can inflate the bubble, and they can also sort of just let the air out. And under the financial capitalism system, it got so out of control that the bankers were bursting the bubbles and collecting on real wealth that those who were left in the wake, who couldn't afford to repay their loans, the banks just accumulated their property, and they did it over and over again. But looking at this repo rate system, it's the one thing that stood out to me on this is that if you have that kind of power, there's no real way that the system would pop, the bubble would pop all by itself. It's a completely controlled thing. So if there was a bursting of the bubble, you can bet your bottom dollar that it was done on purpose. Because what we will later learn from quickly is that what we've already learned in previous chapters is that these bankers have clearly formed a cabal. So you don't have true competition between central banks. They have agreements that they stick to, and they can control the outcomes of the various geopolitical outcomes they want to see in an area like, for instance, Europe. So quickly has brought to our attention how money is really just a magic trick. The bankers pretend publicly to follow strict economic orthodoxy, which they call sound money, whilst in the background, select vested interest groups exploit the system to achieve their own ends and the ends of those who they work for. In this chapter, he describes four periods of economic fluctuations between 1897 and 1947, which he further divides a little bit further, but I'm not going to concentrate on that. These four main periods are, so the first period is reflation and inflation, which occurs between 1897 to 1925. The second period is called stabilization, 1922 to 1930. The third period, it's a deflationary period from 1927 to 1936. And then again, reflation and inflation from 1933 to 1947. It's not that critical to remember these kind of dates because they merge into one another and they have different applications depending on the part of the world where things are a little bit different. But quickly focuses the bulk of his attention on Britain and Central Europe, where there's less overlap. So I'm not going to go through each period in any detail, but I'll try and extract the points that I thought were pertinent. Okay, so if you look at those periods, what you can immediately tell is that the periods of reflation and inflation, they occur before and during the two world wars, with a period of stabilization and deflation between them. So you can easily see that leading up to and during the two world wars, money had to be raised to fight these wars. They basically had to raise finance to create armaments that would just be blown up and destroyed. It's not like they were trading in a sound economy where goods and services were purposefully made to be consumed in a backwards and forwards exchange of trade. So the problem with raising finance is that, you know, the banking system up until that time was, they were sticking to an orthodoxy of adhering to a gold standard. The ultimate result of the pressure to raise finance led to a suspension of the gold standard, as there wasn't enough gold technically in circulation to keep in reserve. The new money was rapidly expanded, even to the point where they issued currency notes. So reserve currency notes, or normal bank notes, you know, which we learned, it's money created out of nothing at all, but at least it had a reserve of gold. And, you know, we could call that funny money. You could say that it became a hell of a lot funnier to the point of lunacy, because what was then issued, we learn, is They just called it plain old currency notes, which were backed by absolutely nothing. You couldn't even exchange them back for gold. Just shows you what they were willing to do. But the point being is that that money, which was loaned to governments, to the public debt, it all had to be repaid in real wealth and in taxation, or in a sort of hidden taxation by the devaluation of currency. So the little guy on the bottom always ends up paying for the games that the big boys play. So during wartime, the question arose around the best way to raise finance. And these were, one is taxation. And quickly just brings out that, you know, if you tax, there's no inflation that accrues and there's no debt. The second way is fiat money, which can create inflation, but no debt. Bank credit or loans, which can lead to inflation and debt. And the sale of bonds, which doesn't lead to inflation, but can create debt. He then goes on to say that the countries funded their war efforts through a combination of these methods, but they did it in a way that was expedient to the banks. They didn't adhere to any real sound monetary policy. And at the end of the day, the result was enormous public debt and inflation. So in order to pay back war debt, war reparations, public debt, the banking fraternity held numerous international monetary and economic conferences. And then he brings up the conference, the International Economic Conference of 1927. And I thought, well, this is very interesting. And I went onto Wikipedia and looked up the International Monetary and Economic Conferences. You would think that there was only one or two, but if you start looking back on it, the first one was in 1867. One of the main guys for hosting it and organizing it was a Frenchman, and his name was Félix Esquerel de Parieu. And what was interesting about that was, well, first of all, going all that way back, they called it an international economic conference. International, not merely European. If you click on these various names that you pick up from the Wikipedia pages, you start looking into each of them, you'll see that they were glorified globalists working towards this united or one economic model for the world. Towards the end of this page, on this Félix guy, this reference to the peaceful federations of the future is all the more revealing, as Parieu anticipated in his book Principes de Science Politique, published in 1870, The Institutional Structure of the Future European Union. How's that? He described a European Union led by a European Commission, whose members would be appointed by national governments, later joined by a European Parliament. How's that? This federation was to prevent European wars and bring about the pooling of currency, transport, post and diplomatic representations. Parieu was aware of the visionary nature of his ambitions and declared to a skeptical imperial senate in 1870, "In the history of mankind, the generous utopia of yesterday can be transformed into a practical and feasible creation of tomorrow, because the world has progressed." And he was elected as a member to the American Philosophical Society in 1871. So, yeah, right there, going back to the late 1850s, groups of international bankers and financiers and bigwigs were discussing a European Union and relating its extension to a worldwide system. All right, carrying on. There were a few ways of stabilizing economic systems after the system became severely unbalanced. So to right the imbalance between global receipts, between countries, foreign trade, and even domestically, they had to try and sort out between themselves a way of weighting their currencies one to the other, because the problem with the system before World War I was that you had new up-and-coming countries that were industrializing. And what it did, it created a whole lot of, it added, first of all, added new players to the international system. And these new players were starting to decide to do things for themselves. They didn't rely on Britain, which was the financial capital of the world. Britain used a form of free trade. So-called free wasn't really free. It was free as long as you bit your lip and did what Britain told you to do. As long as you sold Britain your raw materials and bought the finished goods back from Britain, it was free and fair, in air quotes. So that situation started to change. Britain was very, very slow in recognizing it. It created enormous economic tensions between Britain and its colonial competitors and its former colonies. And the problem with the gold standard was that it was very, very self-limiting. It was top-down directed by the bankers themselves and increasingly through financial capitalism, where groups of bankers were merely speculating over the differences in currency. The bankers had become notorious for not facilitating trade of goods and services, etc., but merely speculating and profiting for themselves at everyone else's expense. So there you had your set of tensions already developing. You had a situation where World War I broke out, an incredible amount of borrowing of money from the banks led to the most incredible levels of debt, public debt, personal debt, debts owed by industry to banks, countries to the banks. The banks insisted that repayment of these loans had to be done according to the old methods of banking. What that forced certain countries to do was to abandon the gold standard. So some countries were trying to devalue their currencies. They were finding ways of trying to beat the system, to create alliances with other countries. What quickly points us to some of the ways in which these countries tried to restabilize after the incredible disaster of World War I. So there were a few ways of stabilizing economic systems after the system became severely unbalanced. They could deflate the system, so they could, you know, they could let the air out of that bubble. They could devalue the currency, or simply through taxation, taxing the public. The poor British public were taxed out of their debt, while other European countries balanced their budgets through devaluation of their currencies, which allowed them to rebuild private wealth a lot more effectively and enabled their currency to outcompete Britain on exports. And as we see during that period up until the beginning of World War, well, up until 1929, leading up until World War II, what happened was that the world was divided into two different types of economic blocks, in a sense. One block, beginning with Britain, and a few of its European partners decided to abandon the gold standard, while America, Germany, and a few other countries maintained the gold standard. And if you remember those four different periods, what you'll find is a group of countries in these two blocks vying back and forth with varying degrees of success against each other. The main economic powers, Britain, America, and France, had a balance of payments system between themselves. And they were sort of like the almost like a threesome that were the three dominant financial forces in the world. The problem is that if one did well and started out-competing, then it would have a detrimental effect on the other two. And as they played around with their gold standard, it became apparent that tensions kept rising. And what then resulted is that it became a battle of putting in trade tariffs, putting restrictions on production, on exports. So the whole system was sort of coming to, it was locking up. Debt was accruing. And particularly in Germany's case, they were so indebted with no chance of getting out of it. You know, basically created that enormous explosive situation of World War II. The way to handle the situation was handled badly by bankers who insisted on returning to the gold standard regardless of the circumstances they faced. They insisted upon the orthodoxy of the pre-war period to the detriment of the countries. So bankers, they do what they want, when they want, and justify to a public who have been purposely kept ignorant of the means the financial fraternity uses to govern them. The banks have the protection of government and powerful vested interest groups. They essentially create the money out of nothing, and everyone else has to pay back with real wealth plus interest, no matter how much they have to suffer for it. It's quite difficult to try and explain the ups and downs leading up until World War II, during World War II, because there's so much detail between the various countries that quickly goes through. It's easier just to try and give some kind of a general summary of the whole picture, but really it's a sort of a competition to see who can come out on top and come out with a balanced budget. So what is clear from this chapter is that international figures, thought leaders, such as the Fabian Socialists, as Nick brought up in his book Fabian Freeway, thought leaders in philosophy, art, banking, business and politics had already been ringing the bells in favor of a single international economic order and by default a single but multipolar or federal political order. And this is where it's quite difficult to, you know, you have to put together an awful amount of information. So in this chapter, quickly is giving you the sort of financial side of things. He's giving you a lot of detail, smaller minutiae, and then he suddenly zooms out and gives you a bigger picture. But you have to bear in mind the previous chapters that we've read. If you've been following Nick's Fabian Freeway, there's all that to take into account. That's all the stuff has been happening simultaneously. It's such a big picture. Okay, so getting back to the start of the chapter, the general gist of this chapter revolves around the fact that the rest of the world, generally speaking, was catching up to Britain and France with regards to industrialization. The entire system of international trade needed a rethink, but the bankers used their system for personal gain and insisted upon their own orthodoxy, financing a new interaction of economic factors with old top-down rules. This put strain on Britain, in particular, to reorganize their own economic model, which relied on so-called free trade, a system which wasn't free, as I've said before, but which existed at the mercy of inferior states doing Britain's bidding, and due to Britain having all the resources, financing, and expertise. As inferior states modernized, as they modernized their economies and became increasingly industrial, they relied less on Britain and Europe for expertise and resources. This led to a competitiveness between established countries and competition from new up-and-coming states, a glut of goods built up in the world economy, everyone having something to sell with a reluctance of everyone wanting to buy from one another, trying to protect their own interests. This led to states seeking to create a series of alliances with select trading partners by imposing tariffs, manipulating gold reserve stores, devaluing currencies, etc., creating trade imbalances and confusion. In the course of all these economic machinations, the gold standard became unwieldy as prices fluctuated on goods so much that the disparity between goods and their price as represented by gold could not be maintained. Two general economic blocks formed out of this, one group on the gold standard and another off the gold standard. A series of economic tensions built up to the point where it exploded, These tensions manifested through economic depressions. So the mismanagement in general of economies is the main reason for the wars. That's what Quigley says, but I think there's a lot more to it. He's talking here with his tongue firmly in his cheek, because what you can see further on, he brings up a few gems that the international banking fraternity truly is international. At their level, they are colleagues. They're not enemies. While their particular countries might be at each other's throats, wrapped up in a war, the various bankers of these countries are funding both sides of the conflict, funding arms merchants, making enormous amounts of profit off of resources needed by one side to the other side, etc., etc. And a book, a very good book to read on the subject, is called Trading with the Enemy, which Alan mentioned a few times. I've read it. It's a real, real eye-opener. When you first read this chapter 7 from Quigley, you get the impression that the banks, the various banks around the world, are competing with one another. But it's false. It's just an impression. So on page 339, I hope it's a page number coincides with your books. So this is a quote. In addition to these pragmatic goals, the powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim. This is a real gem. Nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements, arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. The apex or pinnacle of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, or Basel, I don't know how to pronounce it, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. I just want to read it again. In addition to these pragmatic goals, the powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world or global system of financial control using money, finances to as leverage, as your control, which was to be in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. So by federalizing each nation's economic system, they can call the shots from a central system. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion. Feudalism means it means by fee. You pay a fee. It's by rent. So you get people on the hook. It's a lever. By the central banks of the world acting in concert. So there you go. They couldn't just do it if they weren't acting in concert. I'll read it again. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert. You can see that it wouldn't work if they weren't cooperating. By secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences, the apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements. And I put in brackets, I put there a slush fund in Basel, Switzerland, which is a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. I'm not too sure if you know what the term slush fund is. Look it up on Wikipedia. It's quite interesting. It's generally supposed to be an illegal activity, but the Bank of International Settlements, in a sense, shuffles money around between the central banks, if you look at it in practical terms. So Quigley goes on to remind his audience that the heads of these central banks were not all powerful and could be removed quite easily from their positions because they were there only by the will of those who controlled the very private investment banks. The likes of the Rothschilds prominent players in the 1800s. The role of the Rothschilds has largely been supplanted by J.P. Morgan. And this J.P. Morgan Bank was originally established in the City of London. You know, the head of the snake, the City of London. How's that? By George Peabody. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, howdy. Peabody is funny. They're just peas in a pod over there in their International Banking Federation of controlling the banksterism, I guess is what we'll call it. I've been listening a lot, and I haven't actually read the whole chapter or any part of it, but you've mentioned a lot of things from the previous chapter, and I've listened to a lot of talks that Alan gave about World War II, and we're in the point between World War I and World War II, which it's hard to imagine because I wasn't there, but there was a tremendous amount of acceleration everywhere. And when you think about the fact that we got Germany into the war because they couldn't do anything else but fight their way out of it because they were indebted to the whole world. That's what we're covering right here is how the banks got everybody shuffled into the next position on their little chessboard.
Jared, yeah, you're perfectly right. In the previous chapter, I remember, you know, they basically created the perfect set of tensions between each state where they were locked into like a trap where if they just made one more step, it would have it would backfire a set of repercussions that would affect everyone. So they sort of locked everyone up into a tension. Whoever defaulted and broke that tension first would set everything else off. And from what I can tell is that with this chapter 7, the financial, you see, these guys who control banking are not stupid. Why would they push the old orthodoxy and sort of force fit it into a whole changing world, as described by Quigley here, except to create a set of economic tensions by putting everyone into an equal level of debt?
Well, I would just feel like it's kind of like where we're at right now. Whoa, I need to speak a little quieter. I can hear the echo. Like where we're at right now with the digital versus hard money. You know what I mean? So I'm just so distracting hearing my echo. I think Andrea needs to mute her. Somebody needs to mute their speaker, or it might be coming off yours, but it's what it is now, because like we used to have something tangible, like gold to trade and barter with, or nails or shells, or, you know, something real and physical and tangible. Mm-hmm. And now we're going away from that where you're in cash and you have digital, and it's just the next step. So there's people that want to, you know, have the anonymity of cash, and then there's people that don't care. So it's always slating one person's ideas against another. And the fact that we're in a new age era, there's like these themes of each age and era. You get through each revolution, and now we're into the next one. And that one was just one more step in the process of just making everybody's time worth less and life worth less. It's hard to wrap my mind around the fact that people won't take a value of what their life is worth and say, no, I'm not gonna go along with this. I'm not gonna do this. I refuse to accept this manufactured reality where people can just imagine what the future's worth and people's time. The whole concept of this banking thing is what people's time is worth, time and motion. And they have an ability to manufacture it because people don't want to use their own imagination and think about what's their life is worth. They just are told what it's worth.
Yeah.
It comes cheaper and cheaper because it's the whole pawn game.
Yeah. What I see happening from what quickly is the time frame, the time period quickly is covering down through the ages and right up until the present day, what I see is that the banking system, that the money lenders, the guys in control, they would have an effect on the little guys like us. It would be very indirect. It would come through layers. It would come through the top. And it's basically the big bad wolf is now, particularly with digital coming up, he's going to have his paw right on your shoulder now. All these institutions and layers between the sheep and the wolf have been disappearing. And the wolf is now right there knocking on the door, but is dressed up like a sheep. And the people just can't see it. And with digital, you're not even going to pay tax. You will just automatically be deducted points off your ledger. It wouldn't be indirect slavery anymore. It would be direct. And it's looming. It's very, very worrying.
Well, how can you survive without the chain? You know, it's like you need the chain to – it's like what Alan always said. We build our own chains. We're all – I'm literally holding it in my left hand right now, and I can feel its weight. And what people don't understand is the weight and the pressure. That's the unconscious thing that nobody really taps into is just the – like you said, the paw on the shoulder.
Unfortunately, people have been kept ignorant. I mean, you would think that a lot of what we've read so far with regards to money, at the earliest possible convenience, maybe at the age of 10 or 11, children should have been taught this stuff already. It should be old hat. By the time you start a working career, you should understand this, you know. Unfortunately, everyone just accepts what they're being given as the system, and they don't question it. So it's basically run on ignorance. It's very, very sad that very, very so few understand money.
Darren and Jared, is it all right if I jump in here?
Of course. Please.
I think that point you just made, Darren, is absolutely critical. If more people got this chapter, maybe even just this chapter on its own, out of the rest of the book. And I'm not really familiar with everything in the book. It's a huge tome. But I think this chapter is absolutely critical. Jared said in the chat earlier, the quote you read is famous among people who, like us, who research these things and try to get up to date and up to speed on the real sort of history of the last 100 years. But this chapter has so many nuggets in it. There's a quote here which says, the outcome of all of this, the result of this was that larger and larger aggregates of wealth fell into the control of smaller and smaller groups of men.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, the second part of the chapter where he says this. And this bit is really a peek behind the curtain. It's really that revelation of what's going on, the manipulation of all these different things that are created by the bankers and by the people who design the systems to bamboozle people into thinking that and to get confused about, okay, what is money and what is a currency and what is wealth? And I think one of the key takeaways from this chapter is that distinction that he makes between real wealth and currency and fiat currency and gold. And that's to understand how this trick is played on us.
Nick, just from a practical point of view, I'm in sales, and I was dealing with a large customer called Sportsman's Warehouse here in South Africa. And the manager of the store and I, we had a conversation regarding, you know, these organizations are normally owned by bigger and bigger umbrellas, you know. And this particular manager had quite a good idea of who really owned what. If you took a look at the large corporations, you'll find that South Africa is really controlled by two umbrellas. One, the biggest one, is an umbrella that controls most of your food, most of your household goods, and that umbrella takes you to the UK, takes you to London. Okay, that's half of South Africa or more. And the other umbrella, it's all jointly owned by America. Basically, the United States and Britain have almost a 50-50 share in running this country. It's mind-boggling. And if we knew just how few people control things, I think we'd be astounded, because the illusion is created that there are thousands of corporations and all these alphabet agencies, but they are fronts, and they're
cousins.
They're cousins, and they're owned by bigger umbrella groups above them. But it's quite well disguised. The ordinary person in the street just sees thousands of companies engaged in competition with one another. You know, that's what we see. It's the exact opposite of reality.
It makes a lot of sense when you point out how London and Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, they both have an equal stake in South Africa. They're right down there on the bottom of the continent. You have black people and white people in this weird-ass colonized nation. And you point out you have the children in the mall who suffer sickness from the virtual reality, and I don't know how far you have to drive out away from the urban area, and you get roads that are dug up with tires burning from pissed off standardized Africans, I guess, looking for a piece of the pie. And it's like down there at the bottom of the world is like weird to say this, the pinnacle of the dialectic.
Another example I wanted to give with regards to South Africa, something that I've noticed for a long time. And when I bring it up with people that I'm standing next to in the supermarket or something, they just give me like a bit of a look. But like, I don't know about America or the UK, but you know, there's like a general sort of housewives magazine, homemakers magazine. It's got all the sort of like the leading gossip of the country that you're in. It's got the TV schedule, and it's got interesting articles, and you can look it up online. The South African magazine is called the U Magazine, Y-O-U. And just about every housewife who shops will pick up a copy for the week. And almost without fail, on the front cover of that magazine is the royal family, or a member of the royal family. And now if you ask yourself, South Africa is composed of very few English people, a lot of Afrikaners, and then 11 different ethnic groups of black people, you know, Xhosa, Zulu, Swanas, you know, the rest of them. What on earth has the royal family got to do with us? That's who features on almost every weekly cover of the U magazine. And it's, think about the word U, E-W-E. It's the U magazine for the sheep.
Nice.
And it kind of tells you who's running who owns South Africa. You know, it's in actual fact, South Africa went back on the Commonwealth, I forget when now, a decade ago maybe. But so South Africa is part of the, you know, it's old Prince Charlie is the turd, is really our titular head, but no one knows it.
British Empire 2.0, Darren.
That's it, yeah.
Hi, Frank.
How are you doing, folks? Could I just suggest something? Perhaps people might like to check Dr. Richard Werner. He's an economist, a German economist, and he does an absolutely splendid job at explaining money, where it all comes from, etc., etc.
Oh, write that down.
Highly recommended.
Thanks, Frank. It's very, very difficult to try and explain money. I found a website earlier today, which I put on the group, which explained it you know, quite with language that we can follow, you know. Because quickly, I don't know if you've noticed.
Does anyone know what a tally stick is? Or that was one of the forms of money. I think that somebody was talking about a tally stick once and trying to explain it with money with a tally stick and how simple it could be. Where it came from.
Darren, you mentioned that, didn't you?
Yes, yeah, I brought it up. I actually invented it.
Really?
It's such a simple system. I think it's been invented by children throughout the ages since the dawn of time. It's the simplest way of keeping score. I remember making a system like that and using it with my younger sister. And then like 15 years later, I learned about tally sticks. I thought, you know, it's such a good system. It's so simple and so accurate. You know, you have to have the other half to match. And you can put anything you want on the tally stick. It doesn't have to be money. It can be apples, sweets, bananas, whatever it is, you know.
You know, Darren, just two things. In relation to the origin of all of this, I mean, Nick did an excellent job there some months ago in reading that book, The Romance of the Rothschilds. So that would be another one which I would certainly recommend to people. And the other interesting point that I'd like to make is simply this. The Bank of International Settlements is based in Basel in Switzerland. How interesting is it, the fact that I don't think Switzerland as a geographical area has ever been invaded, ever?
Speaking about Switzerland, I was looking into some of the things that Sean Ross had to say when he was speaking to Melissa. I was looking into Switzerland after hearing what that conversation, and Switzerland, you know, it was a bit of a backwater. It might have had a very important part to play in the grand scheme of things, but up until the central banks decided to put their Bank of International Settlements into Switzerland, only then did the country really become a place of high wealth. Because if you look at the history of Switzerland, it was quite divided and it was quite a poor sort of place, you know. So I think the central banks, they had a lot to do with bringing Switzerland right up there, you know. Can I carry on with?
Of course, carry on, Darren. Switzerland is always neutral. That's kind of common knowledge.
Yeah. The part that I wanted to just bring up with Switzerland is that I don't think Switzerland is central command from Switzerland itself. I think Switzerland has been chosen by the power brokers from everywhere else to have as a neutral zone. Because when I was following Sean Ross, I got the impression that he was giving the impression that that Switzerland is the first principle. It's from where the power comes out of, which I just don't see. I think that it's
who is Sean Ross?
Sean Ross. He is a person that has. Raises a lot of very, very interesting points about the Knights Templars and the history of Europe. And he had a chat with Melissa recently on real history. Very, very good. But I just thought that he gave Switzerland a little bit too much credit. But that's my personal thing. I wanted to get back to George Peabody. If you look up George Peabody, it's quite interesting. Do you know, you often hear on the news, you know, when George Bush invaded Iraq, you know, he often brought up the special relationship that they have with England, or England often refers to the special relationship they have with America. George Peabody seems to have a bit to do with it, because I just wanted to bring out a quote from Tragedy and Hope with regards to this. In this system, the Rothschilds had been preeminent during much of the 19th century, but at the end of that century, they were being replaced by J.P. Morgan, whose central office was in New York, although it was always operated as if it were in London. where it had indeed originated as George Peabody and Company in 1838. And then I just put that little star there, said special relationship, and another little star, the British East India Trading Company flag. You know, if you take a look at the British East India Company flag and you compare it to the modern American flag, well, it's, from what I can tell, the United States of America is a corporation, and it's a British corporation, and it's got a certain nobility that probably came across from Europe, mainland Europe and Britain, and United States has got an unofficial royalty. They don't make reference to that special relationship for nothing. The American flag.
I can comment on that, Darren. Pardon me for interrupting, but there's four Commonwealth states in the United States, and I don't even know how I stumbled upon that, but it's pretty interesting to notice that the logo of J.P. Morgan Chase, it sounds like an amalgamation of families, but it's a hexagon. It's a beehive symbol.
Yeah, be good. Yeah.
And to me, to know that there's four Commonwealth states or Commonwealth entities in the United States tells me everything. Kentucky, West Virginia, Tennessee, I think, and maybe South Carolina. I might be wrong, but off the top of my head.
And Massachusetts, Massachusetts?
I'm not too sure. I just know that if you look at the history of the CIA, for example, it comes straight out of London. It comes out of MI5, MI6, through the OSS. And the CIA, it's not even a public entity. It's a private organization once again. So I think behind the scenes, there's a silent occupation or ownership of the United States. I think really it's trading publicly as a separate entity, but I really do think that it is an extension of the British Empire still, as a silent partner perhaps. I just wanted to raise something else with George Peabody. Now, he was an American, and he moved across to the city of London. In very, very basic terms, what he did, he actually, in a sense, opened a banking account for America with Britain. If you go and look him up, and he basically created the financial system that actually mobilized America into being a proper country with an economy, with a banking system. So there's a whole lot more to George Peabody than meets the eye. And I ask myself, you know, as Quigley says, this J.P. Morgan, it acted as if it was based in London, but maybe it really is. You know, you have to ask yourself, is America not just Britain with a different skirt on?
Well, it's my question. Yeah. I would say it's Britain 2.0 because you think of the landmass of America, and we're not talking the United States. Look at how Britain dominates the whole entire continent of Europe, pushing ever eastward, as it were. But there's so much resources and value in just the population in the land. In America, it's incredible. So they're just expanding their empire. It's obvious to anybody that wants to take a wider view of things, but you have so much wealth just in the baby boomers generation right there. Like, the whole baby boomers could turn the whole entire tide of the whole new world order if they were just to, like, snap up and be like, oh shit, we're slaves. Like, they have all this wealth, but they're dying, and they're not passing along their generational wealth like the elites do. It's insane. They just spend it ad hominem.
Yeah.
I don't understand why they don't think about where they came from.
What you're saying about the baby boomer generation, you are correct. They are believing the propaganda of the retirement of a golfing holiday that they can live in vacation for the rest of their lives.
I don't want to separate the generations. I'm just going to say that. Like, I love my ancestors. I love older people. It's just sad to see that there's like this collective knowledge and wealth and economy with that generation that it's just good people, you know, good people, naivete. It's just, it's sad to see even Silent Generation. It just, you got to remember the people that come before us. And I just wish that this message could be felt from a different perspective, just to say that.
This is how we are divided through generations. We are given different ideologies, different perspectives. So, for example, the boomer generation that you're talking about have been given a different ideology of how the world is. The next generation is given a different ideology, is even given different facts. Like, my dad said there's five continents. No, dad, there's seven. But in between that, there was six. There's nine planets. No, there's eight. Because they're dwarf planets. So even in between generations, the facts are changed. So the younger generation thinks the older generation is stupid because they don't understand reality. That's why I say.
Another thing
dumb, because without language, you couldn't have these arguments. And that's something that I've been stumbling on is language recently, because as an American derelict, I only speak American and I can speak Spanglish. and it's not even España Spanish, it's Mexican Spanish, which is different. And without language, you can't inform people, you can't create a concept inside their imagination, inside their mind. You can't control people without language. And once you started tallying down records and things and hoarding knowledge, it's where everything comes from. And that's how you're able to change facts and change realities, because you're allowed to alter the language. It's like the dictionary in 1984.
Exactly.
Oscar Wilde once said, "I'm not young enough to know everything."
So can I bring up a point?
Yeah,
because I've got an Englishman.
I just wanted to make this point very quickly that Jared highlighted there. In English, there are three different dictionaries. There's the Oxford Dictionary, there's the Cambridge Dictionary, and the Americans often use the Webster Dictionary. In these dictionaries, each word actually has a slightly different definition. And I would like to highlight one of these definition differentiations that is very important in our current time, and that is Islamophobia. Islamophobia in, I think, the Cambridge Dictionary is just being against a Muslim population. But the Oxford Dictionary, in the third articulate of that definition, means that you are against the implementation of Islamic law, Sharia. So one definition means that you're against Islamic people, and the other means that you are against Sharia being put into your law. So under one definition, the Oxford definition, I am Islamophobic, but in the other definition, I am not. So this is how they cause a division.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Darren, tell us what you're thinking.
Well, why don't you just show that there is an international nation. There has been an international group of related people around the world who, as family businesses, occupy entire nations and treat those nations as their private fiefdoms. I wanted you just to highlight something. In the group tonight, we've got an Englishman, we've got a Scotsman, and an Irishman. And I don't want to tell a joke. But while I've got the three of you here, I wanted to ask, you know, if you've ever looked up the nobility that claims to represent the independent home nations in Britain, because, you know, we've got a very proud history and tradition of being English, Scottish, Irish, Welsh. But if you take a look at the nobility and the peerage, the peerage groups, the knights, if you take a look at the names, you'll often get a quaint English name of this baron or that lord, or, and you'll find the exact same thing in the Irish, the Welsh, the Scottish, the English peerage, is that if you start looking at who they really are and you look at their names, there's nothing remotely English, Irish, Scottish, or Welsh about any of them. Most of them are, they've got very French-sounding names. Most of them are Normans.
That's exactly what I was going to say, Darren. Norman extraction, yeah. Yep.
But here's the thing. There's no such thing as a Norman. A Norman was just another name really for a Viking. And they were, from what I can deduce, and I feel confident about it, is that much like the British East India Company went around most of the world colonizing areas, I think that the Vikings or the Normans were a company. I think they were a corporation. And they employed mercenaries from all over the place. So when William the Conqueror invaded England, well, in actual fact, before William the Conqueror went across the channel, there was an attempted invasion from the north with, I think it was a King Harold from Denmark. So the English marched up north and they faced the Danes. They could speak to each other like you and I are speaking. I think it was Stanhope Bridge, I think. They managed to defeat those particular Vikings or Normans. What you can see is that the Normans tried to make a pincer movement in on the UK. So they marched north, defeated the Norman invasion there, and then they had to go all the way down south and face William. And the thing is that William was basically a cousin of the current royalty in England already. So they were cousins. So what you have is an international group. And if you trace them back, you go from Norman to probably, you know, the Charlemagne, the Roman group back then through Greece. And it goes back, but it seems to be the same group with the same operative nature, you know, with all the etc.
I think this was actually demonstrated with Queen Elizabeth II's funeral. I was in Spain here. And the media probably weren't as they were more open than they would be in the UK. And they showed all family in the boxes from Portugal, Spain, all the family of the nobility in the same box. It was amazing.
Yeah, they all get on with each other very, very well. I wouldn't be surprised if they all speak a common language, a high French, I think, something like that. Anyway, I'm going to carry on. So the Bank of International Settlements, there's a fantastic Wikipedia website for them. It's worth spending time really digging into that Wikipedia page. The Bank of International Settlements seems to have been created in 1929 as a slush fund for the various central banks to shift money around the world. To quote again from Quigley, the Bank for International Settlements, as a private institution, was owned by the seven chief central banks and was operated by the heads of these, who together formed its governing board. Each of these kept a substantial deposit at the Bank for International Settlements and periodically settled payments among themselves. And then in brackets it says, and thus between the major countries of the world, by bookkeeping, in order to avoid shipments of gold, they made agreements on all the major financial problems of the world, as well as on many of the economic and political problems, especially in reference to loans, payments, and the economic future of the chief areas of the globe. You see, already there's your global government in action already. The Bank for International Settlements is generally regarded as the apex of the structure of financial capitalism, whose remote origins go back to the creation of the Bank of England in 1694 and the Bank of France in 1803. That's very, very interesting. Quigley hints that the creation of the Bank for International Settlements was the real beginning of a new economic system altogether. It was set up to remedy the decline of London as the world's financial center by providing a mechanism by which a world in three chief financial centers in London, New York, and Paris could operate as one. You see, there's your Norman connection again. You know, there's one larger extended family that are, you know, these three, you know, France, Britain, and a couple of other important European capitals, really, you know, like the Netherlands, dominate the rest of the world. It was indeed to be the world cartel of ever-growing national financial powers by assembling the nominal heads of these national financial centers. Getting back to an earlier statement, Quigley mentioned that the central bank heads are there at the suffrage of the investment bankers. My understanding is that central banks, though private corporations, act as the titular or nominal heads of a nation's banking system, supposedly a private institution. This gives the central banks the power to control loans and repo rates that have such a profound impact on government decisions and policies. However, the real power lies not in these central banks, but on the grand old mercantile or investment banks. Once again, private. Here is a quote from Quigley. It must not be felt that these heads of the world's central banks were themselves substantive powers in world finance. They were not. Rather, they were the technicians and agents of the dominant investment bankers of their own countries, who had raised them up and were perfectly capable of throwing them down. The substantive financial powers of the world were in the hands of these investment bankers, also called international or merchant bankers, who remained largely behind the scenes in their own unincorporated private banks. These formed a system of international cooperation and national dominance. So there you see it there, a system, so which is an organized thing, of international cooperation and national dominance, which was much more private, more powerful, and more secret than that of their agents in the central banks. And that's very interesting because, you know, the so-called conspiracy rumor mill on these YouTube videos will posit the idea to you that the central bank is the all-powerful head of everything, you know. And you can tell from what Quigley has said here that it's not the case. It's the central banks are sort of the top of the heap per nation. They appear to be a public entity, but they are private. And if you go to the Wikipedia page for the Bank of International Settlements, there are as many central banks as there are nations. And every single one of them reports to Basel, Switzerland. And as we can see, it's these massive investment banks like JP Morgan that are the true money brokers that, you know, they push the first domino over and the rest follow.
Hey, Darren. Yeah. When I first heard about that, Alex Jones just called it the central bank of central bankers, but it's their little neutral zone there, like the gray area, but they're still subject to the merchant bankers, I would suspect, because all the weights and measures, these are the people that are actually the movers and shakers. It's the way that the world works is their material world is all about weights and measures and how much blood and water and resources. That's what it's all about is controlling this, the ground level, the base.
Do you remember how quickly he described industrial capitalism? It was a point in time where, at least I think it's where he described how the industrialists were able to finance their own growth because they had so much capital. Well, I liken it to the investment or merchant bankers because these bankers, this is the true private wealth. They aren't bankers. They have title. They own everything. Calling them a bank to me is a misnomer. I think that banking is only part of who they are. I don't think they have to raise capital. I think they are the capital and they can
take it to the bank.
Yeah. They self-finance because they have title to basically every single raw material or resource on Earth.
So let's just be honest. In reality, they're just hoarders. They're just nasty, filthy, stinking hoarders that that don't want to work.
They can back
how
it
about,
up.
How about killing those chaps? Would that description fit them?
Sorry, Frank? Say again?
I said, how about criminals, Darren? Would that description fit them?
That would do it, but in their own twisted minds, they are the owners of the land. We are squatting, and by divine right, we are criminals if we object to that, you see.
Absolutely, and having destroyed the gold standard, got rid of that, they're now clapping away printing money 24/7, fiat currency, which can be used to do all or any of their bidding 24/7.
I added here, I said, what is so interesting is who pitches up when these big investment banks have their private meetings, you know, like the Bilderberger situations. These investment banks themselves are not the actual controllers. They are just entities that rather represent the financial tools and financial weapons that the real controllers use to leverage everyone else with. Because when you have true title, you don't need money. Money is for everybody else, and it's a means to leverage somebody else's body.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. It's you get the you push the pawns, the little people. I don't know. You can't simplify it anymore. It's just emotion.
What does everyone need? They need money. Who supplies it? The guy in control. Therefore, the guy who's got the money system dictates what you do and what you think.
Yeah.
Can I jump in here? I believe wealth, like there's three definitions that I see. Wealth, money, currency. Wealth is the base of everything. Wealth is, in my mind, wealth has a spiritual and a materialistic part to it. So wealth for me is to enrich my life. It's to be with my family, to be emotionally sound. And then on the materialistic side, it is to have land and something to provide my family with. So from that wealth, the materialistic side, we transfer that abstractly to a materialistic entity, which we say gold, silver, or whatever. And that gold that we say that is money that has a well, we call money silver and gold because it has that everlasting property, and then and from that money that we extrapolate to currency, which we say is either digital or the paper currency that we have. But it all comes down to wealth. The wealth is either the land that you have, because the land that you have that you can grow food, you can live, you can provide for your family, you can give an emotional beneficial state, that is, for me, the optimum for everybody.
Well said, Greg. I wanted to finish up by reading, just quoting from the book. Basically, quickly takes you through from where financial capitalism sort of comes to its end. And he gives you, he shows you where the shift occurs from financial to monopoly to the technocratic system. So I'm just going to read here. I'll start now. It's on page 334. So I'll start. The historical importance of the banker-engendered deflationary crisis of 1927 to 1940 can hardly be overestimated. It gave a blow to democracy and to the parliamentary system, which the later triumphs of these in World War II and the post-war world were unable to repair fully. It gave an impetus to aggression by those nations where parliamentary government collapsed and thus became a chief cause of World War II. I think we should take him quite literally there, you know. You can see between the lines that this was arranged to happen. It so hampered the powers which remained democratic by its orthodox economic theories that these were unable to rearm for defense, with the consequence that World War II was unduly prolonged by the early defeats of the democratic states. It gave rise to a conflict between the theorists of orthodox and unorthodox financial methods, which led to a sharp reduction in the power of the bankers. And finally, it impelled the whole economic development of the West along the road from financial capitalism to monopoly capitalism, and shortly thereafter toward the pluralistic economy, which is technocracy. The controversy between the bankers and the theorists of unorthodox finance arose over the proper way to deal with an economic depression. We shall analyze this problem later, but here we should say that the bankers' formula for treating a depression was by clinging to the gold standard, by the raising of interest rates and seeking deflation, and by insisting on a reduction of public spending, a fiscal surplus, or at least a balanced budget. These ideas were rejected totally on a point-by-point basis by the unorthodox economists, somewhat mistakenly called Keynesian. The bankers' formula sought to encourage economic recovery by restoring confidence in the value of money, air quotes. That is, their own confidence in what was the primary concern of bankers. This formula had worked in the past only when it had more or less incidentally reduced costs, especially wages, faster than wholesale prices, so that businessmen regained confidence, not in the value of money, but in the possibility of profits. The unorthodox theorists sought to achieve this latter more quickly and more directly by restoring purchasing power and thus prices by increasing, instead of reducing, the money supply, and by placing it in the hands of potential consumers, rather in the banks or in the hands of investors. This change in the accepted theories after 1934 was a slow growth and formed part of the eclipse of financial capitalism. In the long run, it meant that banks would be reduced from the masters of the economy to become its servant in a situation where the major economic decisions would not be based on the supply of money, but on the supply and organization of real resources. As a matter of fact, the whole relationship of money and resources remained a puzzle to many and was still a subject of debate in the 1950s, that at least a great victory had been won by a man in his control of his own destiny when the myths of orthodox financial theory were finally challenged in the 1930s. The end of financial capitalism may well be dated at the collapse of the gold standard in Britain in September 1931, but on the personal side, it might be dated at the suicide of its most spectacular individual, the Match King, Ivor Kruger, in Paris. And then he goes on to describe how this guy, Ivor Kruger, basically using financial capitalism, created a monopoly in the matchsticks matches. He owned over 80% of the world's matchmaking capacity, and he actually became basically a personal banker to governments. Until the gig was up, the bubble burst, and he committed suicide. And with his suicide died financial capitalism, as Quigley is trying to get across. But I think, you know, tongue-in-cheek, Quigley is basically saying that the banking system had now introduced a new banking method, a technocratic one, 1929, with the setting up of the Bank of International Settlements. You could see how they were going to federalize the world along economic lines. So now they've advanced to the point where there's another big transition, which old Klaus Schwab has called the Great Reset. Yeah.
The funny word there, economy. And the passage that you just reflected to us is, I would say, the transition from the bankers having power to the science and engineers and the psychologists. It's the hoarding of knowledge and power. And that's the capstone and the all-seeing eye, because if you know everything, you can determine reality. And
and the thing is that those people were always there. It's just that they're coming closer to the door. The wolf is coming closer to your door. And the face of the structure that people are used to operating in is changing. It's becoming...
You can feel it. I'm just going to say that. I don't know if I've said it already, but you can feel it. You should feel it. You should really feel it, because it's in the air. The age of Aquarius. It's literally in the air.
Yeah. And you can see it if you're in public, and you know, the public are being given levels of fear and worry and anxiety. And I was just saying earlier on the group, you know, people struggle to make eye contact with you nowadays. They're so preoccupied with, there doesn't seem to be a future. I think they've sort of robbed people of so much agency that when you do that, people no longer, they just accept what will be presented to them. You can see it and feel it.
Doesn't it feel good, Darren, to look somebody in the eye? Doesn't it? It really does. Like, just look someone in the eye, man to man, human to human. You can see it.
That's what's so nice about going to the smaller little towns, is that the people, they literally see you. They make eye contact and they give you a friendly smile. Even if you're just driving down the road, people will just wave at you because they haven't seen you before.
Yeah. It's something that, it's weird. That's, where people wave and don't wave, and people make eye contact and they don't. And it's another line of division there where you can, like you said, drive out into the country, these small villages where people don't, you know, you still have Amish and Mennonites and tribal folk. And if they see you tumbling along in your big gold truck or whatever, they'll, you know, wave. It's like, it was something that people used to do, wave and look you in the eye and shake your hand.
And it also makes you feel reassured to know that human nature is not as bad as you think. If you change the environment, you can turn people into, you can create certain behaviors out of people, but people in their own natural sort of, you give them their natural space. Human nature is wonderful. We are good, you know. It's when we are caged up on top of each other and put into debt, all these unnatural structures around us, that you get this dysfunction and, you know, we start nipping at each other and that kind of thing.
Are you getting into germ theory or terrain theory here? I'm sorry. I couldn't help it. I'm programmed, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, if I do my business trips as a salesman, I go into these little towns. I have such a good day. I drive back home with a good feeling, you know? So the true human nature, that's not tampered with is good. And we don't have to, you know, when we, in a city and we're watching TV and we start looking out the window and we see everyone else and we think, ah, what a moron, you know? That's not our natural state at all.
I would just to add that working over in the cul-de-sac wasn't as bad as I described. It was I was treated very well, and you know, the guy even patronized me, and he said, you know, I hate to say you know so much, but you know, they give us a solution, just vote. And he said, I know.
Oh yeah. You don't have to participate, you just vote, yeah.
Yeah, I was just trying to, you know, like, make jokes and be subtle and whatever, but it's just like, he agreed. And it's just weird to know that everybody has this, like, underlying knowledge of what's happening, but collectively, you know, we can't do anything, and it's just, you know, you just talk to somebody, your average person, like you said, no eye contact, not waving. It just depends on what type of the world or what area of the world you're in. And, people's minds have more fences and layers and more and less. It's an experiment.
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks very much for participating and listening. Andrea has just given me a slip of paper saying that I need to wrap it up. Otherwise, we're going to give Melissa too much work to do, because I think she wants to limit things to an hour and a half. So we have to call it an evening. So thank you very much, guys.